This is the Takeaway Podcast for June 15th, 2016. We're going to bring you a special extended conversation with writer Don DeLillo. For the regular news and our continued coverage of the Orlando shooting, you can head over to thetakeaway.org. Don DeLillo. He's a slight, wiry man in his late 70s with clear eyes and a poker face behind which you can be sure of its intense, thoughtful observations about our world. He's a devoted New Yorker, a disciple of history and myth in the America he has watched change in the decades following World War II. DeLillo's body of work constitutes a magical history of America, from the Kennedy assassination in the book Libra, to New York City in Underworld, to the madness of the television age in White Noise, to his current novel, Zero K, about faith in technology and immortality. The big ideas in all of his books come from a humble character, deeply serious, but with a streak of steel-bladed humor. It's great to meet you in person and to have the time to talk about some of your work.
Thank you.
In your new book, you talk about convergence, and it seems in a funny sort of way that freedom has become extremely rich people wanting to be immortal.
I think that's a fair statement. and the novel is set in a very remote part of the world, somewhere in the vicinity of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, and it's an underground facility, and it is the facility itself is called the Convergence, and people go there essentially to lengthen their lives beyond the moment in which they expire, so that in a frozen state, in a pod, a cryonic pod, they may live to the point where technology ultimately reaches such an advanced level that these individuals can be brought back to life. And the whole point of the convergence is life extension.
Why is that something that – I mean, I guess obviously only the rich can afford it, but why are these particular characters so interested in it?
Well, in one case, a woman named Artis wants to do it, and her husband encourages this. Her husband is a very, very strong investor in the convergence. He has money in it, a great deal of money, and – this is part of his interest in the very fact of life extension. But at some point, although he's a healthy man, he decides that he would like to join his wife, Artis, in one of these cryonic pods. And this is the essence of the story, the fact that a healthy individual is willing to do this, is willing to undergo this process, becomes what the narrator of the book, who is this man's 35-year-old son, this is what the narrator is focused on throughout much of the novel.
Is this equivalent to religion, this faith that this is all going to work out, is a kind of 21st century convergence of faith and science and economics?
Faith and science. It's life everlasting, based not on faith alone or on deep belief in God, but based strictly on technology.
Convergence is a character, it seems, in your latest novel, but you've been doing a lot of convergences down through the years. I remember in Mao, too, there was a convergence of Mikhail Gorbachev and Marilyn Monroe and all of the characters of the Cold War crumbling coming together. You love those sorts of mixings.
Yes, I do. But oddly, my memory of books of that era is not very sharp these days. And I have to be reminded, not, of course, about Mao too, but some of the other characters. And I tend to forget the names of important characters in past novels.
Well, that's perfectly fine. I'm just wondering if the main elements, I think, of your work, New York, America, and a kind of global sense of confusion about what's going on in the world. Has New York changed as a character in your work? Does it more represent America or less represent America today?
My sharpest memories of New York are 60s and early 70s, when it was a very interesting place, often for all the wrong reasons, because it was dangerous and because there was a great deal of crime and violence. And the sound of police sirens seemed almost ever-present. This New York seems a bit more settled, and people are aligned at times in certain categories that aren't all that different compared to earlier years here.
So there's not the fighting, the antagonisms in New York. Everyone's kind of being New Yorkers together.
In general, I think that's true. And, of course, there is the resettlement of Brooklyn and now moving into the Bronx, we understand. And this has brought a kind of unusual calmness to parts of New York City. When I grew up in the Bronx, Brooklyn was another planet. And I still feel an odd sort of reluctance to go to Brooklyn because there were the Dodgers in Ebbets Field. And we were the Yankees and the Giants. That was an enormous distinction.
So again, are we becoming homogenized? Are we losing that sense of enclaves?
I'm not sure. I think in New York City, we'll always be hearing 23 languages in a given day. And I don't think that that this country is being homogenized. No, I do think that the foreign voices sometimes give birth to conflict.
Do you think the calm settling of New York means it's less able to be the American story because it's less filled with the competitions and the story of America is the story of fights between a lot of different groups, and that's no longer taking place in New York.
No, it is taking place in America, but I think less so perhaps in New York. And the city does seem different to me, and one significant difference is not based on philosophy or psychology. It's based on clear vision of traffic. Everything is traffic in New York, taxis, trucks, and buses. And they are all waiting for a light to change, waiting for the gridlock to dissolve. This is something that I find unavoidable. It doesn't necessarily make me feel negative about the city. It's just something, it's another element that was not nearly so present when I lived here at an earlier age.
In Libra, you talk about the Kennedy assassination. And in a lot of your work, you take stories that are from the headlines and from real history and try to imagine what their significance really is in a global sense. Looking back on it, do you think the Kennedy assassination is more or less of an important event than it seemed at the time you were writing about it?
It's beyond the living memory of so many people today.
Right.
And in my own experience, it tended to shape the work I did eventually. I wasn't writing novels in 1963, but I would soon start. And I think it had an impact on everything I wrote, either directly, as with Libra, or in a more indirect way. And on the 50th anniversary, I was invited to a film festival in Telluride, Colorado. And I decided the thing to show this year was the Zapruder film. It is a film festival, and here was a 26-second document highlighting, lowlighting the assassination of the president very directly. A man named Abraham Zapruder had a Bell & Howell 8mm camera. He took pictures. And we did show it at the festival. We did some repeated footage and extended footage and stop action. And it had a powerful effect on people who hadn't seen it. Very strong.
You also have written about 9/11, and I feel in your writing that you're trying again to estimate the significance of that event. We're not as far from 9/11 as we are from the Kennedy assassination, yet that event seems to have diminished in significance, and there are much bigger events that were even consequences of it that we have to deal with today. How did you think of the history that would come from 9/11 and what's actually come from it?
I certainly haven't escaped the powerful memory of 9/11. And after it happened, through a friend who lived in that area, I managed to get access to that part of Lower Manhattan. And once I did, on those very lonely streets with broken windows and garbage beginning to pile up, I knew I had to write about it. And I did, first in an essay, and then, of course, some years later in a novel. And I still have a very strong a memory of not only of what I experienced, but of what we all experienced, a visual memory. And whenever I look toward Lower Manhattan, what's there? Not twin towers, but a single tower. And I always associate this view with what happened to bring about the fact that there is only one tower now. Hmm.
The era that we live in now is obsessed, it seems, with the end of the world and dystopian landscapes of one kind or another. You find it in teen movies. You find it in all kinds of movies. It seems as though the end of the world was more a reality during the Cold War, when we were talking about explicitly nuclear winter and going into fallout shelters and all those sorts of things. And indeed, in some of your work, you describe the end of the world kinds of scenarios that came out of the Cold War. How do you think our notion of the end of the world has changed since the Cold War has ended, and all that seems like a distant memory?
The first sentence of Zero K is, everybody wants to own the end of the world. And this is a reference to the fact that this topic, this subject, has become quite prevalent these days, no longer rooted in the fear of a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union, but in the fear of climate change and other elements as well. It's interesting that in this novel, the essential element becomes a kind of hope for the future, a belief in the future that I'm not sure we ourselves share. I don't know that people have a great faith in future, as it's supposed to be part of an American religion to believe in the future. But I'm not sure it has maintained the same strength that it used to have.
Do you think we've lost it in America? Do you think we've just lost a belief that this can go on?
I think something has changed in this country. And I do think that part of it is a diminished faith in our future. Not necessarily that we believe in some kind of destruction, but I don't know that we believe in America's ability to continue to advance in so many different areas and to continue the global leadership that we've had since World War II.
Do you think that's a good thing? I mean, in other words, if the United States didn't feel so responsible for the rest of the world, would that be better for all of us?
That's a tough question to answer. I think in some ways it's a positive element, but I also think that our view of ourselves is going to be not quite as strong and positive as it was for decades after World War II.
In the discussions of race in America, a lot of authors have poked at a kind of American mythology that's breaking down, the idea that we're all about freedom. No, they say, we're in fact a nation that was built on slave labor and exterminated indigenous people, and that we need to recognize those things. And until the American mythology is kind of blown away and truth replaces it, we can't have a real future because the myths don't hold up anymore.
I think there's more truthfulness in our dialogues concerning this matter. But as far as the future is concerned, what are we faced with immediately? We're faced with the claims of a presidential candidate that surpasses anything in our living experience. What will Trump tell us tomorrow and the day after? And how will it affect our sense of ourselves as Americans? And I think that's as much as I care to say about that.
Who is Trump? Is he a person or is he a symbol, a caricature? Is he playing a role?
I don't think he's playing a role. I think he is the role. I don't think he's aware of a kind of self-consciousness. I don't think he's self-aware. I don't think he's self-conscious. I think it all simply flows into the broadcast schedule.
And the fact that his popularity seems to dovetail with a certain kind of anger among voters, is that represent a constituency or is he just inheriting something?
For many voters, he has come along at the right time, clearly. Mm. But this is a subject too far flung for me to say much more about.
What's far flung mean?
It means I'm not paying very careful attention.
Because you're terrified?
No, no. It's something that seems at this point to be pure media.
I see. So the significance of it will reveal itself much later.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's your strategy as a novelist.
Well, I don't know that I have a strategy. I follow characters. I follow an idea. I write sentences. There's no overall plan at all. What I like about writing is the act of writing, the act of creating sentences, making paragraphs, feeling the way in which a character begins to develop into a fully dimensional person. That's what writing is to me, language.
Is your fascination with all languages, do you think human beings have a love of language, or are we trying to find a single language with which to communicate, some sort of English plus Chinese plus the internet?
Well, you may be right about that supposition, but in my case, I grew up listening to Italian as well as English, of course. It was a provincial Italian. It was a kind of Italian that would not be recognized in certain parts of Italy. And so I didn't really learn that much in terms of the language itself, and I'm terrible at speaking other languages. And when I wrote Underworld in particular, I returned to the Bronx of my early years, and I was able to retrieve all that Italian-American slang, all those curse words. And my only problem was figuring out how to spell them. And my Italian editor had never heard these expressions because they were born in parts of Italy and in parts of the Bronx, and the merger was a third language completely.
Do you want to do the cryogenic immortality thing?
Do I want to do it?
Yeah.
No.
But you're 80. You're conscious.
I'm not. Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. When do you turn 80?
November.
November. Yeah, I turned 60 in couple of days.
I was just a kid. I was just a kid when I was 60.
Just a kid when you were 60. That's good to hear. So if you're conscious of your own mortality more at the age of 80 than at 60, do you have a sense that you want to know how it all turns out? You raised the Trump question. There's certainly some implications that you'd want to hang around for. Nuclear winter, that could still happen. I mean, there's a lot of DeLillo scenarios that we could be looking at in the next 100 years.
You may have to settle for reading my books because I may not be here, but I'm in no hurry to leave. And the truth is, it's inconceivable to me that I'm going to leave anytime soon.
I get that impression from your writing, actually.
But, of course, it could happen while I'm sitting here speaking into this microphone.
Well, please, no. That would not be
and
good.
Then the program would end and I could, you could read from my books.
I could. We could do that. It's really terrific to talk with you, and thanks so much. And we should have you back maybe to give some commentary on the election as we get closer to November. Are you open to that, possibly?
Impossibly.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to my conversation with the author Don DeLillo. His latest book is Zero K. To hear more of today's news, you can head to thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, whose goal is a world without blood cancers, funding research for new treatments and targeted approaches to therapy. Learn more at LLS.org. By Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business, and in-store print shops offering customized presentations, booklets, and manuals, in-store and online. Staples, make more happen. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at curious.com/PRI. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.